Currently, outside the KSCO studios, it is 69 degrees. And now, stay tuned for The Way of Love Live.
The Way of Love Live.
Hey, 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 Way of Love.
The variety show committed to bringing you positive stories and life-affirming messages.
Combined with enough inspirational music and satirical comedy to make it worth everyone's while.
With informative interviews and dynamic guests, we present the best of what our global community has to offer.
In a format we lovingly call short attention span theater, we combine vaudevillian styles with futuristic sound effects technology for maximum entertainment value.
Together we focus on the most important issues of the day by exploring informed and enlightened approaches wherever we can find them.
Using serialized fiction, we bring to life great stories from the past and sci-fi possibilities of the future.
Thank you for joining us in our multimedia foray into the positive possibilities of our planet.
Hang on, you never know what to expect.
Here we go. It's the Way of Love Live. Way of Love Live. I'm Raquel, and I'm here with
MC.
I'm here with my co-host MC. We have a very special show for you today. We're going to be talking about marine mammals and acoustics. We have very special guests that we can't wait to talk to them about their expertise and their research on marine mammals and acoustics.
And we have some great sounds to share with everybody and songs, sharing the interspecies language and talking about things that unite us all.
Absolutely. First of all, I'd like to introduce our special guest today, Dr. Brandon Southall. Hi, Brandon.
Hi.
Welcome. Brandon is associate researcher at UCSC and president of SEA Inc. Thanks for joining us. And we also have Dr. Jeremy Goldbogen. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Jeremy is biologist at Cascadia Research, and they're here to teach us about acoustics and marine mammals. So we really appreciate you taking your time out on this beautiful, gorgeous day in Santa Cruz.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
We are so lucky to have caught you, as you were saying in your email, that you're about to take off on another expedition. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Jeremy is down here from Olympia, en route to Santa Barbara. We'll be taking off next week for a two-week research project to measure some aspects of behavior in whales and dolphins and look at the sounds they make and how they react to sounds in their environment.
Excellent. And we also have another special guest today. We have Caroline Casey, researcher at Año Nuevo and also part of the SEA project. Hi.
Hi there. I can hear you.
Welcome to It's the Way of Love. So we're going to have some great conversations today about research. And first of all, we'd like to invite Mr. Past. It's a very special date in history. Is that right, MC?
That's right. Every day is a special day. That's what we aim to point out by our This Day in History series. And it's been a very interesting day, July 21st. So much so that I'm going to mix it up a little bit, Raquel.
All right.
This time I'm going to put out what I believe to be the most significant dates and jump around in time, not just go back in time as we normally do. Perhaps I think the most significant thing happening on this date was in 1969. And as you know, I like to point out synchronicities on certain dates.
Absolutely.
And how things tied together. And two very interesting things happened on this date in 1969. And those were one for the Americans and one for the Soviets, which was very interesting. For the Americans, Neil Armstrong first put his foot on the moon at 2:56:15 Greenwich Mean Time and uttered his famous words, "This is one small step for a man, but one giant leap for mankind." Now, what's very interesting is that on that same date, July 21st, today, in 1969, the Russians' Luna 15 impacted on the moon after 15 orbits. So you think about that, and it tells you just about how charged the space race was at that time. On this same single day in 1969, both of our countries, in a way, left our mark upon the moon for the first time. Going back, another significant thing on this date, in 1925, the Scopes monkey trial ended with the official verdict that Scopes was guilty of teaching Darwinism. And more significantly and symbolically, he was fined $1. And this ultimately ended the legal battle between those trying to enforce the no teaching of Darwinism, and in some ways still persist to this day, but the Scopes monkey trial ending on this day was a significant event in history. Another one that you'd be interested in, as we like to talk about the history of rock and roll, this is one that our whole family and a lot of our friends would appreciate. This date in 1990, The Wall was performed by Pink Floyd on the Berlin Wall. And at the end, yes, on this date, and at the end, The Wall, for the first time, although it had been open, was symbolically taken down by the crowd, and this was, to everybody present, the actual end of the Berlin Wall, this date, 1990. Going back, I just want to point out some interesting other parts of history, is that today, the U.S. Veteran Administration was formed in 1930, and we like to think of taking care of supporting our troops and everything, but understanding veterans and their needs and everything, and actually only became an official administration in 1930. And another sport interesting on this day, jumping around, was in 1989. We like to think of Lance Armstrong as the American and the Tour de France, which just ended recently. But in fact, on this date in 1989, Greg LeMond won the Tour de France, the first time for America, in record time. So that was another significant sports event on this date.
Do you know the time?
What was his time? Boy, I don't know. That would be Google up. Somebody should call in with that particular detail.
Yes, and today we invite callers. Please call in with your questions and comments at 831-479-1080. Please call in.
That's right. We like to point out funny things that happened on this date, too. And this date in 1984, another interesting correlation, was the first official case of a robot killing an American in U.S. history. That's right. Where's Will Smith when you need him? In this date in 1984, an American was killed at a car plant in Detroit when a robot went out of control and killed the worker. This is the first known case in 1984 this date. Finally, as we like to point out, major points in California history. This date in 1846, the Mormons founded the first English-American colony in California in San Joaquin, southern part of the valley. And so that concludes this day in history. We do a lot of different research for this show. I want to point out, though, one particular website, brainyhistory.com, has become a major resource for me, and then basically taking it where they send me another various links on the web. But brainyhistory.com is a great resource for all history things. And so I also know that there have been a lot of pop songs about whales. There have been a lot of pop songs that have incorporated whales, and in the style of this show, we want to do some things throughout where we play you, the audience, and do some of the things that bring in the sound of whales.
We have some very inspirational songs about whales, and I also found in the playlist that you got, MC, that there's some kind of bleak whale songs about whaling, and I'm not sure if I'm going to play some of those.
No, you don't have to play all of them, but there are some great fun ones in there. Certainly, it's been a part of pop culture, saving the whales, and, I think the important work acoustically now, I have to say to our guests, I've been reading SoCal 10 all day, I think your work is excellent. It's about time. The baselines that you guys are setting for sonar levels for all these programs, it's really very important. So we're very glad to have you guys here, and we're gonna. I want to ask some specific questions about your next study, which is coming out, correct?
Yeah, we'll be in the field starting next week.
So we're going to talk about all that. First of all, we're going to play a little pop culture song here. It is the Partridge Family.
Ah, yes. Went out on national TV and changed a lot of people's perception about whales and the sound.
We have a very exciting show today. We have researchers from Santa Cruz, Dr. Brandon Southall, Dr. Jeremy Boldgogan, and Caroline Casey, all top researchers researching marine mammals. We have important messages from our sponsors, and right when we come back, we're going to be talking about why sound is so important for whales.
You know, they say that in 1842... on a plantation in Alabama, the slaves unearthed a huge skeleton, the bones of a giant whale, a leviathan, from the time when all the world was covered with water, from the Andes to the Himalayas, and even Alabama was deep. And the slaves looked at the huge bones, and they said, "These must be the bones of a fallen angel. These must be the bones of a fallen angel. Out on the ocean, out on the water, we look for signs of him. He looks like a giant snowy fountain, then he disappears, he's a speck on the horizon. We see him moving past, the flash of a tail, his beating heart, he's in pieces and parts. It's easier for than to find a whale who hides at the bottom of the ocean. It's easier to sail around the world."
Today we're talking about looking for whales and researching on whales. And our special guests today, Dr. Jeremy Goldbogen and Dr. Brandon Southall, were here with us the whole 2 hours, and we have experts on whales and marine acoustics, and we have Caroline Casey on the online. So please, we welcome your questions and comments today. Please give us a call, 831-479-1080. Dr. Southall, you had a comment about that song we were listening to, the Partridge Family Whale Song, right?
Yeah, I thought maybe I'd start by bring something back to Jacques Cousteau, who a lot of people relate the oceans to, and he did a lot of amazing things to bring awareness to oceans issues. He called the ocean the silent world, though, and he was kind of didn't really have that one exactly right, as you heard from the song, and a lot of people know. A lot of animals make sounds in the ocean. It's far from silent. Different places sound different, from whales to dolphins to all sorts of fish to seals and sea lions, snapping shrimp, the sounds of the ocean itself, the sounds of earthquakes, lightning striking the ocean. There are a lot of natural processes, rain falling on the surface of the water. So it's a dynamically rich acoustic world that these animals live in. And it's important to them in much the same way that light and seeing is important to people and other land animals. Underwater, light doesn't travel very far. Smells don't really, they get mixed up so that they can't be used in the same kind of way. And sound travels long distances and can relate information about where things are that a lot of these animals use for key life functions, finding each other, finding food, avoiding predators, finding their way around. And we know that these sounds that they make and sounds they listen to are completely vital for their livelihoods. One thing that I noted in that song, though, was this kind of common perception that people have had about the oceans since early days, which is that, you know, the ocean is this vast environment that is sort of beyond the reach of people and beyond the reach of the people to impact. There was a verse in that song that said something like that, and we know that's not true. You know, from overfishing to the marine debris to all sorts of things, the oceans are big, but they're still impacted by people. And some of the work that we're doing is trying to understand how the sounds that people make, either on purpose or sort of as a byproduct, could actually impact these animals that rely on sound by interfering with the sounds that they make or listen to, or affecting their behavior in ways that might harm them. So the project that MC mentioned is specifically focused around that, measuring behavioral reactions to sound. But a lot of the work that we've done within SEA and within the partnerships we have at UCSC has been centered around what kind of sounds do these animals make? What does it mean for their lives? How do they use it? And then how can they be affected by sounds that people make?
They're down there. They have very little air, correct?
Right.
What's going on? How are they making songs for so long?
Well, that's an interesting question, and they're very different. If we say, I mean, the project and Jeremy's work especially has been focused on whales. We do work with whales. We work with other, in this project, we're working with other toothed cetaceans. Dolphins and porpoises are called, toothed cetaceans. They have teeth. Baleen whales have baleen. Basically all animals that live in the ocean that have a backbone, including fish, can hear and make sounds. And we even know that some invertebrates, like lobsters and shrimp, make sounds too. So the way that they make them is about as varied as the animals themselves. They do tend to produce sounds with structures in their body that move air back and forth. We know that dolphins have these little compartments in their head, basically, where they can move air back and forth between them. And it's like it moves between a membrane that's kind of like if you hold the end of a balloon and you kind of squeeze the end of a balloon and let the air out of it, and it makes kind of a high-pitched squeak. That's how the sound mechanisms in a dolphin's head work. Some animals make sounds like shrimp. They'll make sounds by clanking their pinchers together, or lobsters will rub something down the side, or fish have things that kind of thump their swim bladders. So there's all sorts of mechanisms to make sound. And some of the marine mammals that we are interested in, some of the seals and sea lions, they're amphibious. So they have this different challenge of making sound and listening to sound both underwater and in air, which, as you know, if you go underwater, if you don't have a mask, you can't see very well in either, and your hearing is different. So they have a special kind of a challenge, and they make sounds the way that, like a dog barks in air, and then underwater they keep their mouth shut.
So, Doctor, perhaps we can talk also about the sounds that we make. Is it true that in the study you use, you mimic some of the military sounds, but you do it at a much lower amplitude?
Yeah, that's right. We're interested. It's a pretty applied kind of study. There are some parts to it that are, you know, just telling us basic behavior. Some of the species that we've put some of these tags on that monitor how they dive and where they move. They're giving us just basic information that we, you know, that
right.
Basic biology.
Dive away from the source of the sound, or perhaps change their course or their actions because of the sound.
Right, exactly. So we're trying to use a controlled and with specific kinds of protocols, so we're not causing a really strong reaction to a watered down version, basically, of a military sonar to try, and other kinds of sounds as controls to try and understand. What do these animals do when they experience these sounds? We know that they're happening on a regular basis on the California coast. The military and other people use active sonars to find things. And we're kind of missing some key information about what do they do when they hear these
Could
things.
Could there perhaps be safe bands in the sound frequency where if we kept those quiet, that the whales and other cetaceans may be less impacted? And if we used ultra high frequency, perhaps.
Right. One of the questions that we're asking really is about that, and it does sort of boil down to the what can we do about it, and we know that there have been some times and some places where loud sounds that people have made have caused these animals to be harmed, to come up on the beach and be. But part of why we're doing this study is we don't know why. We don't know if it does it hurt them directly, or does it change their behavior in some way. We're trying to tease apart the very kind of beginning stages of that. But in order to do things like inform people who would try to change the way things are done to be less impactful on the environment.
Why is sound important for the ways they communicate and getting their needs met?
I think social interactions is one of the really key ones. So if a dolphin is trying to reunite with its mother, they'll use a series of sounds to find one another in the middle of a, you know, often dark, complicated kind of environment, so that many animals will be able to recognize the sounds of one another if they have individual differences in the calls that they make. Some of the studies that people have done on seals and sea lions have shown that they have individual differences and they can find one another. So it's pretty important in mother-offspring interactions, as one example.
And how far can these sounds travel underwater?
Well, you raise a very important point, which is that of space. These animals are, you know, we're talking about things that range from the largest animal that's ever lived on the Earth, which is a blue whale. It's one of the species that Jeremy and other people have been studying, and we've tagged in the SoCal project, you know, down to a tiny little damselfish or a little shrimp living in a cave. These they operate on these really radically different space scales. And the bigger, in general, the bigger the animal, the lower the frequency of a sound that they make. So like the whale sounds that we heard in the Partridge Family song, they're kind of a moaning, low kind of a sound. And like I mentioned, the dolphins use these really high-pitched kind of squeaking kind of sounds. Those, the properties of water are such that low frequency sounds can go long distances, thousands of miles. We know that we can hear whales in certain places hundreds of miles away. We know that we can hear earthquakes thousands of miles away, or some sounds that people make can be actually be heard thousands of miles away. But the lower the frequency
to the blue whale, I could also hear echoes coming off the ocean floor, which I'm sure the whales themselves were hearing. And it reminded me of certain musicians that will start a loop. And so the blue whales, particularly in the deep water whales, seem to have this ability to both sing in unison, but then in harmony with themselves.
Right. Some of the rhythmicity and the order of things like humpback whale song, it's truly remarkable. I mean, it's
right.
As scientists, we admire the structure and the complexity of the social interactions and dynamics that these things convey and all that. But as just people and observers of the ocean, and Jeremy and I are both musicians as well, you know, just seeing the complexity, the innovation, the timing of things. Sometimes when we see animals vocalizing in aggregation, one animal will time its call relative to either be on top of another animal's call or spaced in between them, and they're very clearly aware of the acoustic environment that they're operating in.
And I do have some whale songs on top of what you're saying. If some of you are confused out there, we're listening to various whale calls of different species. So would you, any of you, call yourself expert in the whale songs?
Well, there's a variety of people who have looked at like humpback whale song in over time, and they've focused specifically on that. Most of the work that I've done, and I probably should have mentioned earlier that I worked for NOAA for 6 years. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's the part of the government that both sets the rules for human activities in the ocean, or one of the agencies that does that. And they also support a lot of research and monitoring on various parts of the oceans, but ocean acoustics being part of it too. And a lot of the work that I've done is both in the laboratory here at UCSC, measuring how seals and sea lions hear and are affected by noise. But it's been a little bit more applied. So when I was with NOAA, a lot of my job was to be an interpreter for people that made decisions, to say, what's the science that we have about sound and rules about it?
Okay, I'm trying to picture something in my head, and all I can picture is the lady at school that puts headphones on the students, and you're supposed to raise your hand if you hear the beep. You can't do that with whales. What are you doing?
You actually can do some of that, and maybe Carolyn can chime in. She works at UC Santa Cruz, and I've worked with some of the labs there that basically do that. We don't ask them to raise their flippers, but the animals can be trained to respond to sounds and tell us when they can hear them or not hear them in a controlled kind of a way, where we actually can measure their hearing in a behavioral kind of a sense.
Okay, Caroline, what do you want to tell us about this?
Oh, well, as Brandon mentioned, I have worked actually as an animal trainer for UC Santa Cruz Long Marine Laboratory, and we're really interested in how kind of the sounds that Brandon has been describing affect various species of seals and sea lions, but particularly right now we're looking at Arctic seals. So essentially what we've done is, using positive reinforcement, we basically train them to listen for sounds in kind of a soundproof chamber, and it's really similar to what you might have done when you were little, if you had listened to sounds, and like you had responded in a way, if you heard it, then you would raise your hand, and if not, then you would basically not do anything. And we found that that's the most reliable way to get a gauge on what these animals are able to hear. And then in turn, we can provide that information to, say, somebody like Brandon, and he can basically communicate that to, you know, lawmakers and policy people, and they can basically make larger real changes depending on that type of information that we're providing. So we work currently right now with 7 different animals. You know, we have 2 California sea lions, a harbor seal, and several different species, or I guess 2 different species of ophidias. So that's kind of where my past experience has been.
The program was started in the 80s by Ron Schusterman, who is a famous marine mammal scientist who was one of the early marine mammal researchers in marine mammal hearing and also intelligence, cognitive abilities. He was one of the founding members of the Marine Mammals Society of Marine Mammalogy, and he looked at whether seals and sea lions used echolocation or sonar like dolphins do, and he found that actually they don't, but they do have a remarkable set of listening capabilities. So that lab's been there over almost 30 years now. Pinnipedlab.org. One more quick site I'll give before we break here is Discovery of Sound in the Sea. Docits.org might be one if people want to check out some marine mammal sounds. It's a fantastic peer-reviewed website that's got a lot of multimedia of sounds of animals and other sounds in the oceans that people might want to check out.
Everybody, we're talking about how we would research and find out about acoustics on marine mammals, and we have experts here on It's the Way of Love Live on KSCO, and we were talking about how this hearing screening test works on marine mammals. Can you tell us why is this research so important that you're doing?
Well, back to the point about sound being so important to these animals. We know that they use it for all these vital functions, and understanding how they use it and then how it can be how that can be interfered with by sounds that people make is a really pressing kind of conservation issue. Industries that make sound, like to find oil and gas, they use sounds to go into the ocean bottom and find where oil is deposited. They need to know how are those sounds going to affect animals, and are there times where there are more species around that may be impacted, that there are ways they can, you know, modify their activities to be less impactful. And then on the other side, the managers, the Coastal Commission, the California Coastal Commission, the Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, these agencies that set rules for what people do, they need answers to how do these things impact animals and what can we do about them. So there's a variety of techniques that we've used. Carolyn mentioned some of the work that can be done in the lab, where you bring an animal into kind of like this studio, where it's a quiet, controlled place. You can play sounds to them and measure how they respond in a really controlled way. One of the problems with that is it takes a long time to train them, and there are certain species that you can't fit a whale in this room. So there's some of the animals that we can use those kinds of tools on, and then other species that we can't. So captive studies have their advantages: control, replicability, the ability to calibrate what their animals are listening to. But field studies have the flip side, where you're actually measuring the animal in its real environment and how it responds to sound. But then you sort of lack some of the same kinds of controls. But what we're finding is that a combination of lab and field work is telling us more and more about how these animals perceive their environment with their ears and how they differ and how they use sounds to live. And so the techniques that we're using, and maybe we could talk about some of the technologies, because what we've seen in the last 10 or so years is that as in many areas of science, as technology and memory space and battery power and the technologies have have expanded. They've really enabled us to ask new kinds of questions. So if you want to know, how does a sperm whale 1,000 meters under the ocean over half a mile, or a beaked whale a mile under the ocean, how is it moving in three dimensions to pick up a piece of food? You know, how could you do that? I mean, it seems like such an amazing and difficult thing to measure, but people have created these kinds of sensors that are placed on the animals with these little suction cups. They hold on to the whales, they dive, and we can measure how they move by getting these things back and interpreting the data. And maybe, Jeremy, you could talk a little bit about tags and how some of these tools are letting us learn about diving and foraging behavior in marine mammals.
Yeah, so these are self-contained digital tags that have a sensor suite that tells a lot about the acoustic environment of the animal, as well as the orientation and the fine scale movement of the animal. And so a lot of these sensors are familiar to us, and that they exist in probably everyone's smartphone at this point, or if you have a Wii or a PlayStation. These sensors are called accelerometers and magnetometers. And so when you take your smartphone and you move it 90 degrees, the screen knows to switch with you. And so that's an accelerometer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's measuring acceleration due to gravity. And if you moved your phone back and forth, it would measure that acceleration. And so from those data, we can recreate what the animal is doing underwater, how fast the animal is moving, when the animal is actively swimming, when it's moving its fluke.
Do you have a device attached to it?
For
this study?
For this study, we use a piece of equipment called the D-Tag. And so this is a self-contained tag, and so all the sensors are embedded in a high-performance material, and then suction cups emerge out of that material, and then we depress the tag onto a surfacing whale. And we have a VHF radio transmitter on the tag as well, so that when the tag falls off the whale, floats back to the sea surface so we can get the data. So all the data is actually recorded on the tag on the whale, and we have to get the tag back.
The guts of it are not much bigger than a phone, really. There's the flotation makes it a little bit bigger than that. It's just slightly positively buoyant, but they attach on just with suction cups, so they're not breaking the skin of the animals. They carry this package around for an order of tens of hours, but we're getting very fine scale movement, dive depth, three-dimensional movement, speed, the sounds the animals make, the sounds that are in their environment. And so by putting these on, we can measure how are they diving and behaving without any kind of extra sound, and then in a controlled way present sounds to them and measure what their responses are. And not just did they move away, but how did it change their diving behavior? How did it change their acoustic behavior? And it gives us a very fine scale resolution on what's their response to these kind of sounds.
What kind of changes have you seen in behavior?
Yeah, good question. We've seen things that an interesting answer to that. Like most scientific answers, we'll tell you it depends, but I'll explain how it depends. We've seen that some of the animals seem to not really do anything. They seem to hear some of the sounds that we make and just keep on going about their business. When that business is feeding on a large aggregation of food, it seems to have an effect on their responsiveness. So, you know, if you were hungry and there was a big giant plate of nachos on the table and somebody was playing really loud music that you didn't like, you might sit there and listen to it because there's a bunch of food there. And we're seeing that the context of what the animals are doing affects the way that they react. And sometimes when they're doing something important, they will not respond, at least in an outwardly evident way in terms of vocal or movement. We do see reactions, though, in some of them, and most of those involve moving away, right? So temporary kind of avoidance of an area. also sometimes changes in vocal behavior. So some of the species that we've tested that appear to be more sensitive, and among those are...
Such as
beaked whales are these deep-diving, squid-eating, fairly poorly known open ocean animals that tend to live in fairly small groups. There's actually quite a large number of species relative to other other marine mammals, but we don't know them all that well. They're hard to see. They live pretty far out, and we were already kind of keyed into them being important to study because within the strandings of marine mammals that have happened from sound that we know about, they've been disproportionately among those species. So in the Bahamas, in the Mediterranean, in Spain, Canary Islands, where some of these things have happened, they've been...
Australia, too, right?
There have been strandings in marine mammals, not beaked whales and military sonar that I'm aware of, but of the ones that are, you know, sort of pretty clearly correlated with active sonar, almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them have included these different species of beaked whales. And, you know, we've tried to figure out why, you know, why would they be more sensitive? The work that we've done in this project in Southern California is an extension of a project that happened in the Bahamas in 2007 and 2008, looking at a different species of beaked whale. But within both of those studies, we've done just a handful, but enough to say these guys really do look like they have a different type of response than like the large whales that we've studied that have milder kind of responses that seem like they depend to some extent on what the animals are doing. Within the beaked whales, they seem when they hear these kinds of sounds, they tend to just basically stop their vocal behavior and move away, sometimes at a pretty good clip. You know, we've seen all of those behaviors kind of return back to a baseline. We know that we haven't, you know, harmed any of these animals in studying them, but just at low levels, seeing those types of responses let us sort of extrapolate. And the point of some of these, it's like if you were trying to study like a drug, you wouldn't give somebody the dose of a drug that would cause something really bad. You would start with a dose that was a little bit less than that and see what the effect is in a controlled way. And we're trying to do that in ways that are protective of the animals that we're trying to study to understand, but then extrapolate kind of what their responses are. And it looks like these beaked whales really are more sensitive. What's interesting is that it looks like they're more sensitive to almost any kind of sound. We've tried a few different types of sounds, both natural sounds and sonar, simulated sonar, but also some kind of control sounds that are not exactly like sonar. They look like they're just kind of generally sensitive and responsive to sounds. And we have some ideas about why that may be. We know that in land animals and in some marine animals, their social structure is very dictates how they respond to a threat. So if you're an animal like a pilot whale that lives in a big group, your response to threat might be to just kind of coalesce and use your group as defense. But if you live in a group of two or three out in the middle of the open ocean with nowhere around to hide, your response to a threat might just be take off. And so we think that these social dynamics may affect their response to risk or threat in a way that changes or explains in some way why they respond differentially to sound.
Is it possible to get away from these effects? I mean, you're talking about, you know, how in the low range they can travel many, many miles. So is that possibly what happened at certain levels? They just couldn't get away from the sound and it overwhelmed them?
One of the interesting things about the events that we know kind of the most about that have happened in the Bahamas, in the Canary Islands, in Greece, is that they've been in places where it's like a canyon, you know, like if you went, my son Logan's who's sitting in the audience with us here, we were in the Grand Canyon a couple of months ago and we were, you know, yelling our names down in the Grand Canyon. And you think about how the sounds bounce around in there, bounce off the walls, and
it echoes, right?
Yeah, it echoes around. And if you were in a place like that underwater, and you wanted to you wanted to get away from a sound, it would be harder. You know, it would be confusing as to which way to go if you were going to try to move away from a sound, especially if there were multiple sound sources in a reverberant, echoey kind of environment like that.
Hi, Logan. I just wanted you to say hello to everybody.
Hi.
Was it pretty cool to play around with a sound in the Grand Canyon?
Yeah, it was.
You know, and Logan's been a part of this for a while. When I was a grad student at UC Santa Cruz, when Logan was born, he's 12, but he was there and got to know some of the animals at the marine lab, and so he's seen how we measure some of the hearing in those animals. Did you think that was pretty neat, Logan, the way the animals are trained to do these studies?
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
The other part of this that Logan saw when we lived in Washington was and this issue that we're talking about sonar and marine mammals, has been in the news for a while. It's been in the courts for a while. And starting in Southern California, in the Ninth Circuit Court, the various environmental groups sued the Navy over their use of these kind of systems and environmental analyses, or lack of having environmental analyses. And that went up through the courts and went all the way to the Supreme Court. In a case, and Logan was with me in the audience at the Supreme Court when we heard this issue raised up to that level, and it's it really has become one of the issues that has got a lot of people interested in how, you know, what these kind of effects are and the rules of how the Navy does their important training operations. They need to have their people that use sonars, they need to have them practice and train, and the partnership that we have between the Navy and NOAA and private researchers like Jeremy and other academic scientists on this SoCal project really speaks to, and I think, you know, kind of in the theme of your show, we're trying to get answers. You know, we're trying to not just sort of assume that things are fine or as bad as they possibly could be. We're trying to get science to inform the decisions about where and when things can happen and how we could try to reduce impacts. And that's there's a real proactive kind of science first approach to this that I think is important people understand about this project.
We're having an exciting whale conversation here on It's the Way of Love Live at KSCO 1080 AM. We're going to open up the lines for callers the second hour, so please call in 479-1080. Welcome back to hour two of It's the Way of Love Live. I'm Raquel, and we're here with our special guests, researchers here from Santa Cruz, Dr. Brandon Southall, Dr. Jeremy Goldbogen, and Caroline Casey, researchers on acoustics of marine mammals. And we have a lot more to explore, and we're going to talk about technology.
One of the things that's really enabled us to ask some of these questions about how do these animals use sound and how do they react to it has really been enabled by these tools. We talked a little bit about it earlier, these kinds of tags that measure movement and measure acoustics. There are a variety of other kinds of technologies that we can use, things that people like the Navy have been using for a long time, like sonobuoys, where you drop a buoy in the water and it lowers down a hydrophone and you can listen and you could drop an array of them and kind of get an idea of where things are coming from. But also using things like fish finding sonars to map the prey of these animals. And Jeremy's done a lot of work on foraging, feeding behavior in whales and how they respond to different types of prey patches. And Jeremy, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the use of active sound to measure whales, and then using that information about imaging the whale's food and their behavior using the tags and the interaction between those two technologies, because I think it's a really fascinating tool that we've used a little bit and you've used in other contexts and projects as well.
Yeah, so using a high-frequency acoustic beam, you can get an idea of the prey field that the animal is experiencing. And from research in our group and a few others, you can actually predict what a whale's behavior will be given a given prey field. And a lot of these animals exhibit extreme body size. These are really big animals. They need to feed a lot. And so when there is prey, you can predict that they're going to be feeding. And so what we can do is we can take that prey field data and superimpose it on tag data. And so if we've tagged a whale, we will situate ourselves in such a way that we can measure the prey around the tagged whale. And so when we put those two data together, it gives us a really rich context of the environment in which these animals are foraging.
And talk a little bit about some of the advanced computing systems and software that's being used to kind of facilitate that visualization.
One of the newer pieces of software that was developed by Colin Ware at the University of New Hampshire is called TrackPlot, and it's this great visualization and analytical tool that takes the data from the tag, these streams of data that we're getting, and it reconstructs what the animal's doing underwater in three dimensions. And you can also incorporate the prey data as well, and so you're seeing, it's almost like looking at it from the perspective of the whale, as if you're on top of the whale and you're seeing what's happening, and you're kind of, it's almost like being on a roller coaster, and you're kind of, when the whale is diving down, you can get a sense of what the animal is experiencing. And so it's quite a powerful tool.
So really, this
I'm
just
really curious about that data. Is there a baseline of quiet? I mean, what is it like out there in the middle ocean now? Is it noisy everywhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. We know, and you know, an important point that I'd like to make to people, some of the what we're talking about here with these Navy sonars and reactions that you can measure over short time scales, it's the part of this issue that people have really kind of been aware of, you know, these acute, loud kind of events and dramatic things that can happen. The other side of that is that there's a lot of sound going into the ocean that, you know, it isn't as loud as a big sonar system or an air gun, but there's a whole lot of them, things like ships. And there are areas where there's concentrations of shipping where just the whole background particularly low frequency, but that the whole background acoustic environment can be changed, sort of like living in a city. You know, it's just generally louder. You might hear one horn, but in general, there's just kind of a din of sound that's elevated. And we know that that's...
Right, and those low frequency sounds are the ones that travel the furthest, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. We know, you know, that the low frequency part of the acoustic environment, pretty much in the northern hemisphere, with the exception of a few places in the Arctic, is above what the natural ambient is almost all of the time. People that want to study processes of acoustics, like you know, how does wind affect low frequency noise, they have to go to the Indian Ocean to do their research, because you can't do it in the northern hemisphere because of ship noise. We know that that's increasing in some areas. We know it's variable, and it can change as a function of economics, for one thing. You can actually track some of the patterns of noise tracks, economic patterns. So there's some interesting things and trends that we've started to see. People have started to pay attention to that issue a little bit more. I would point people to another website called it's NOAA.setsound, CETSOUND.org, or just put NOAA and cetacean sound mapping into Google and it'll pop it up. 2 months ago in Washington, we had a culmination of a process that lasted about 18 months, where two parallel working groups looked at the spatial and temporal patterns of the distribution of cetaceans, whales and dolphins, and the distribution of average noise from human activities, shipping being the main one, but also things like oil and gas surveys and fishing vessels and construction of offshore facilities and things like that. And it was the first time, it is the first time, that the federal agencies have started to think outside this little box of one thing at a time, started to think about things in the bigger sense of there's multiple things happening, sounds can travel long distances, and even things that may not cause a stranding event, but they can change the acoustic environment, the acoustic habitat, can affect animals in sublethal ways that on a population level could actually be important. We know that there are places where whales could hear themselves over hundreds of miles 100 years ago, and they can only hear themselves tens of miles now. We don't know exactly what that means. It may not, you know, it may not mean that, you know, it's killing animals or you know, harming them in ways that we can directly measure. But when you're changing the acoustic habitat of animals that have relied and evolved to live acoustically for tens of millions of years, there's some concerns there, and people are starting to think along the lines of the kinds of questions you're asking there, MC, of how far can you hear these things? What kind of things could we do? Could we, you know, work with the people that make ships to maybe try to make them a little bit quieter? We started a group within the International Maritime Organization, which is part of the United Nations. When I worked for NOAA, that started up about 4 years ago, to try to work proactively with the shipping companies. They don't care about the sound of a boat. You know, the Navy cares about the sounds that they make. They're making them for a specific purpose. The sounds are a particular frequency based on the physics of water and other things. But if you're a ship, you're just moving a box from point A to point B, and incidental noise is not something you care about. So if there's a way that we can design ships to be more efficient and quiet, it could actually have a significant impact on the acoustic environment, and we're working towards that. It's a slow process. It's a big industry, and any international body, it takes a long time to work through. But people are thinking about these things now. They're thinking about the chronic, cumulative, interacting kind of factors on spatial and temporal scales that actually mean something. We're kind of thinking outside of the traditional way of looking at these kinds of acute effects.
You're giving them the data that they need to actually change and make those decisions that will make a difference. I see the military coming to the point where they realize that they can do what they want to do, which is detect enemy submarines or what have you, and not disturb and kill the marine mammals. And it is in their interest, ultimately, to have a small footprint. I think they'll decide it's in their best interest to not be disturbing the marine environment wherever they go.
And, you know, I think their research in this area and some of the measures that they have taken into account, I mentioned earlier some of these events have a common feature in them that they've happened in these reverberant kind of canyon-like environments. And the U.S. Navy and other navies have put in some measures to try to generally avoid those areas, and if they do work in them, to train in those kind of areas to do certain things. So they're, I think you're right that they're adapting. They don't want these things to happen. They're kind of a side effect of something that they're doing, but they're trying to learn, and we as scientists our role is to try to help them so that we can make better decisions as a society.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about solutions and what we can do to help whales and help better the acoustic environment here. So It's the Way of Love Live is happy to have these special researchers from Santa Cruz. Welcome to It's the Way of Love Live, and we're going to be talking about what people can do to help the acoustic environment for marine mammals. So, Dr. Brandon, please tell us, what's out there for us? What can people check out?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that really helps for people to do and you know, people always want something to do, and there's a few things I think we can point people towards, but just knowing that sound is an important aspect of these animals' lives, and that we should think about how we relate to the ocean and how we can relate things to our kids about when we're on the beach and you see these, you know, you see dolphins, you're running on Seacliff Beach where we live in Aptos, and you see dolphins moving up down the coast, you know, realizing that they're using sound to find their way around. You know, there's ships off our shores. There are things that we could do that we haven't really thought about. So the main thing is for people to just know that this is a part of the acoustic, I mean, a part of the ocean. Mm-hmm. You know?
I liked what you said earlier. We're not just looking at a flat surface. And I remember when I started scuba diving years ago, I would be amazed afterwards at the 3D environment that I had just experienced. And I was not even able to see any of it once I was back on the surface.
Right. And there are a lot of, you know, letter writing kind of things. And I would... It's good that people do that. I mean, having been on the other side of some of those letters, when I worked for a government agency and somebody would send a letter to Barbara Boxer, Barbara Boxer's staff person would go to somebody and know if it was a question about ocean issues, they would send a letter to somebody in NOAA and say, can you help Senator Boxer answer this letter? And some of those things, just getting those things are important. It's important, I think, on this and any other issue, if people are signing onto a petition and there are been a lot of, you know, letter writing kind of campaigns and petitions on this issue of sound in particular, people should really think about things before they just put their name on them. But if it is something that you really agree with, those things they have an effect. Mm-hmm. It's more effective if you write an individual letter instead of putting your name on a big list, but they both have an impact.
There was some good news on strandings, right?
Well, I was mentioning in the last segment that we have seen some changes in the areas where the U.S. Navy operates that have been modified based on this observation of these canyon-like places being strandings, where strandings have occurred disproportionately, and they've modified the rules for their training operations in those kinds of places. And we haven't seen, at least in places where the U.S. Navy's operated, we haven't seen any strandings in the last few years. So that's good. We're hoping that learning those kinds of lessons can help them, you know, continue to do what they need to do more safely.
Mm-hmm, the trend spreads. We have Mike in Scotts Valley. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, welcome. How's it going? Just listening into the show. It sounds pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how do you get more information? I mean, what sources, like on the learning curve, do you get information on to learn more about just what the Navy's program is with sonar and so forth, and how they're, taking measures to keep sea life safe?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mentioned in the first hour of the show, I mentioned a little bit more general of a website, but it has a lot of really great links to some of these things. It's called DOSITS, Discovery of Sound in the Sea. And I'm a little biased because I'm one of the scientists that has put it together, but it's peer reviewed. It's got sounds you can download. It has links to basic information about sonar and about natural sources of sound in the ocean. It's got links to the Navy has a marine mammal program within the Office of Naval Research that does a lot of work in this area. It has links to other research facilities. Our website, Southall Environmental Associates, SEA-INC.org, has a lot of links to research programs and also to some of the Navy labs that are doing work in this area.
All right. Well, thanks for the references. I'll check it out.
Thanks for calling. And we have Rosalyn in Redwood Valley. Hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking up the subject of the U.S. Navy. I'm really pleased because in Mendocino County, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, we've been working very hard to protect the National Marine Sanctuaries, the Marine Reserves, biologically sensitive areas from U.S. Navy warfare testing, which includes missile exercises, bomb blasts, sonar use, new weapons testing, electromagnetic weapons testing, radar, laser, and several new types of sonar. And I just wanted to let you know that I have put together with some others the most comprehensive environmental impact statements from the U.S. Navy. I think there is, besides the U.S. Navy, in other words, websites themselves, and also the links to the U.S. Navy environmental impact statements. And I put this together on agriculturedefensecoalition.org. There are 6 sections on the U.S. Navy. And I'm concerned because Senator Boxer, Senator Feinstein, and 6 other senators in a letter to NOAA referenced the fact that and I'm going to quote just one little small paragraph, the Navy plans to increase the number of its exercises or expand the areas in which they may occur, and virtually every coastal state will be affected. Some exercises may occur in the nation's most biologically sensitive marine habitats, including national marine sanctuaries and breeding habitats. In all, the Navy anticipates more than 2.3 million takes, significant disruptions in marine mammal foraging, breeding, and other essential behaviors per year, or 11.7 million takes over the course of a 5-year permit. And this was June 19, 2009. And this was written to NOAA Chief Dr. Jane Lubchenco.
Dr. Brandon, do you deal directly with the Navy, or
I worked for NOAA prior to that that period of time, mm-hmm. and a lot of my role there was when they would submit applications for specific activities or range wide activities, like the environmental impact statement that the caller is referring to. My role was to try and use the science that we had to try and make those assessments of what the level of impact was. She's right that many of the areas that some of these things occur in are in biologically mm-hmm. Important areas. And I think what we're trying to do with this project is to give some specific answers to environmentalists, to regulators, to the Navy themselves, to really accurately predict what those impacts really are. The 2.3 million take number in there is largely a function of assuming that there's a there's a sound level that's going to cause a behavioral reaction, and then taking that level and overlapping it with the density of different species and tallying those up until you get to 2.5 million. One of the things I mentioned at the beginning part of the call is we know that there are species differences between how these animals react, and we know that for some species it depends on what they're with. There are these contextual kinds of differences. So how those numbers are calculated and what they mean have really come from a very simplified kind of assumption that's that number, that threshold number, is the same for all different species. And so what we're trying to do is provide some real information about what is the real risk. I don't think anybody, including the Navy, thinks that there's not a risk of impact on these animals. But what's the real risk, and what, how do you quantify it? How can you do it safer?
And I have a question. Is there a group of concerned citizens who's speaking out on behalf of the sonar on marine mammals?
There have been a variety of people that have, both in legal action and in the kinds of things that the caller mentioned. And, I think independent assessments of these kinds of impacts beyond just the kind of environmental impact statements that, that the Navy or the oiling. We spent a lot of time talking about the Navy. There's a lot of other people that are, creating sound that have to apply for these kinds of EISs that, they'll hire a contractor to do an assessment. Having people independently assess those things or get public kind of awareness and discussion about them going is a very important part of the process. There have been a group of environmental groups. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been sort of the lead on this issue, working in the legal realm.
Rosalind, do you have anything else to add to Dr. Brandon?
Well, I'd like to say one thing. When the Navy just put out two 5-year warfare testing expansions, one that goes all the way now, that's going to encompass all of the smaller ranges between Maine and the Canadian border down through Florida and all the way through the Gulf of Mexico. And they're going to make this into one entire large range. The Navy website for this range is www.afteis.com. That's www.afteis.com. And you can read their draft environmental impact statement there and their plans for this entire huge area, which will encompass all of the smaller ranges on the Atlantic seaboard. Now, the only thing that I can say is that the Navy has already been approved for testing in the Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico. They've been testing in the Southern California range for a couple of years, the Northwest Training Range Complex, which is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Northern California, the Hawaiian Range, and the Marianas Complex Range in Guam. And now the U.S. Navy is expanding the Northwest Training Range to go from the Gulf of Alaska all the way to through Northern California into the borderline on Mendocino County. And then there's another range that has just been expanded. It's the Hawaii Southern California Range Complex. Their website is hstteis.com. That's hstteis.com. And you can read their draft environmental impact statement there. The expansion of these ranges means that there's very few areas in the Pacific, the Gulf of Mexico, or the Atlantic where the Navy would not be training. And the issue is not just sonar. It's bomb blasts, missile exercises, toxic chemicals, and a whole host of other problems in which no environmental group is addressing at this time.
Thank you for bringing up these important issues. Our phones are ringing off the hook here. Thanks for calling in, Rosalind.
Can I make one point real quick?
Absolutely.
I think it's important for people to realize that some of the just because the way these things are bundled in terms of the analysis that's done doesn't necessarily mean that these areas are being expanded. They've, one of the things that happened in the first round of environmental assessments that the Navy did, and there were 18 or 20 of them or something like that, was there was a fair amount of redundancy in the analyses that people felt, including some of the environmental groups, felt could be handled more efficiently or effectively if the assessments were done on somewhat larger scales. There were different densities of animals that were used in one versus the other. There were some discrepancies. There were some confusion. And I think that people shouldn't automatically assume that because the assessments cover larger areas that the activities and the training activities are necessarily expanding into new or larger areas. So I'm not a Navy. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Navy for any, you know, in any way, shape, or form. And I'm not saying that there are not some new areas that might not be included in some of those. It's just the I do know for a fact that the analyses covering some of these larger areas doesn't necessarily mean that there's expanded training happening in new places.
Oh, but they've asked for outside to be able to train both inside and outside all ranges. And when you look at the Navy maps, you will see that the boundary of those ranges has changed and that their environmental impact statement increases the number and scope of exercises within this new boundary, as well as within the boundaries of the smaller ranges that are combined in these larger range complexes. So I hope you'll take a look at the maps. I hope you'll take a look at the maps and read the EISs for both of these.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that information.
You're welcome.
So we were talking also about tools and technology. Now you're establishing the baseline data to give to the Navy so that they can set the limits for what is safe for marine mammals, right?
Right. And you know, I think it's clear that we need information and additional data that comes from actual activities as well. And one of the things that is important in some of these assessments that are being done and some of the monitoring that's being done is that while experimental things like we're doing can give some direct kind of somewhat more controlled information, there's another part of this where monitoring around things that are happening that are the real scale, that are the real things that we know are happening in California and other places, that there are people looking at some of those things. I think the previous caller made the point that, you know, some of these kinds of activities are happening out there and people aren't necessarily monitoring or you know, assessing some of these other kinds of things. We do tend to get really focused on the sonar and the sonar from specific ships. But there are other things that are part of these big exercises that people need to keep track of and other kinds of things. Maybe when we come back from the break, we can talk about some other things happening off the California coast that people might want to be aware of in terms of underwater acoustics.
Absolutely. Please stay tuned after these important messages. Having whale talks here on It's the Way of Love at KSCO, and we have another 15 minutes or so with these whale experts and researchers. We have Carolyn on the line, and I know you haven't had a chance to comment in a while. Carolyn?
Hi there. Hello.
Hi. Now, we would love to have you back to talk about what you're doing with California sea lions over there at Long Marine Lab. We invite you. We have an open invitation to come here and talk the whole time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I just was here to kind of support Brandon and Jeremy and to just, you know, make sure. I think one of the most important things about this work is that it is accessible to the general public. In Boston, I think that you do see kind of this split between that.
Oh. You know, Carolyn, we have a little bit of a bad connection. So
you guys are doing a great job.
Yeah. So thank you so much for being part of our show. And
well, I'll pick up what Carolyn was mentioning there about, you know, being accessible and open to the public. She spent some time working at the California Academy of Sciences. She has a really strong background in public education and interaction, she's been a very important asset to us in helping us do things like this, to tell people this is why we're doing this kind of work. We know that sounds are important to these animals. We know they can be affected by them. We're trying to get some answers. Here's how we're doing it. We're doing these experimental approaches, but with specific kind of protocols, so we're not causing the kind of effect that we're trying to understand, and why, and what some of the benefits we think of that are, which is better decision making, both from the people who are proposing activities that make sound and for the people that are setting the rules. And we've spent a fair amount of time talking about the Navy. I'd like to maybe just kind of expand it a little bit to say that when you listen in the ocean, you can hear everything. You can hear things that people do. You can hear sounds that the animals make. You can hear the sounds of the environment itself. And we know that using listening arrays of sensors can help us understand natural systems and how they're affected by people in ways that you can only sort of we've only kind of guessed at by making, you know, one little measurement here or one measurement there or an extrapolation from this to that. But the ability to track things over time and space listening is a very powerful tool. The systems that people have had in place to listen over large areas have largely been military. The Navy's had listening sensors for 50 years. Things like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, where people are monitoring for nuclear explosions, use sounds, but they listen, you know, to monitor for things. Mm-hmm. But they've been kind of military type of systems. What we're seeing now is that there are civilian kind of systems that are possible that are being used on some small scales. But there's a huge potential out there to do more with some of our ocean observing systems. There's a lot of sensors. We've got some in the Monterey Bay, a lot of NOAA buoys and U.S. Geological Survey kind of sensors, and a lot of oceanographic buoys that are measuring currents and chemistry and things like that. We haven't put enough listening sensors on those.
A question for you, too. What is the most obnoxious sound that you've had to hear out there?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is when you listen in the ocean, if you listen for very long, you'll hear something you never heard before.
Yep.
And we've heard a lot of interesting things that we couldn't identify. You know, we were off the Channel Islands a couple years ago with some of the most experienced underwater acousticians in the world, and we're listening to some sounds that Nobody could figure out what it was.
Are your soundtracks top secret?
No, none of the stuff we do is classified. Okay. I mean, there are systems obviously that are.
And next time you come, you can bring us a sound sampling of what you're listening to, I hope.
That'd be great.
Absolutely, and we can, you know, we can link to some systems. I keep going back to this Docet site, but we've put some of our samples up on there. I really encourage people to go and listen to that. But you know, one of the things I think that people could do in this regard, it's hard because it's not like recycle or, you know, don't dump your oil down the drain. I mean, both of which are important, but
yes.
For sound in the ocean, there's not kind of more of what it is, I think, is trying to do the kind of things that the earlier caller mentioned, which is be informed and you know, ask questions of people that are doing these kinds of environmental assessments. On the science side of things, it's pushing the agencies and their funding of ocean systems to listen more. We've got a lot of buoys and sensors out in the ocean that don't have hydrophones on them. We should be listening to the ocean more systematically, more carefully, mm-hmm. in a more dedicated way with a system of data access that's open to everybody. People should be able to listen to these places in the ocean.
Can you give us an idea of how loud are we talking? How loud is too loud for these animals?
Well, and people want to kind of boil it down to that basic mm-hmm. question, and I understand that. That's
are we talking about decibels double their normal range or quadruple, 10 times? How loud is it getting for them?
One of the things that we know is that a lot of these animals themselves make loud sounds, and they appear to be adapted to deal with fairly loud sounds, not surprisingly, because they live in an environment where, you know, every minute in the world somewhere there's an earthquake, and you can hear those things underwater a long way away. Lightning strikes the surface of the ocean, you know, every second somewhere, and there are these naturally loud sounds. That being said, things that people make, some of the military sonar systems or underwater explosions or these seismic air guns that look for oil, they're loud. You can mm-hmm. hear them hundreds of miles away. So it's not a simple question. Part of the point, we published a paper in Conservation Biology last year that's linked from our website that makes the case that we've really sort of limited our assessment of this question by trying to boil it down to how loud is too loud, because what we know in some cases is it's not just how loud it is that matters. If you take something that maybe isn't as loud as something else, but it has a certain pattern to it that may...
My refrigerator... It's driving me nuts.
Right. So one of the questions...
Constant, loud, bad. Not too loud, but just a bad noise.
Right. I mean, so they could be... There are certain types of sounds. We know that mm-hmm. sirens have this pattern because it alerts our auditory cortex in a way that makes it alerting. You know, so you could have
Doctor, you bring up a really good point, which is the data and sound is all relative. So is there a baseline? Have you studied... like a pristine sound environment to find out what just these beaked dolphins, the beaked whales might be reacting to in a normal environment?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's something I readily admit in as a maybe a limitation or at least a caveat with some of the work that we're doing in Southern California. We're studying their responses to these simulated military sonar sounds in a place where they hear them on a pretty regular basis. In places where they don't occur very often, they could very, very easily have different and potentially stronger kinds of responses. Now, the flip side of that is the military does tend to operate most of the time in certain areas, like in Southern California, where they have this underwater range of listening sensors where they can track things that are on them. And it's actually a tool that we use. There's people that work with the Navy that have adapted these arrays of sensors for monitoring marine mammals with them. And they tend to work in those places. So it's a very important point. There have been comparative studies between, for instance, remote areas in the Indian Ocean and the Northern Hemisphere to look at the difference.
Certainly an avenue for further research, because it's very exciting what you're saying about these new acoustic arrays becoming available to a lot of smaller groups, smaller research groups, and now a large mountain of data that's becoming available to the community, you know, the scientific community. I think also about we talked on the program about ROVs wandering across now they have a lot of, vehicles that could have acoustic sensors and could be broadcasting acoustic data.
Absolutely. We just put a paper into the Interagency Ocean Observing Council on exactly that. We're integrating listening sensors into the integrated ocean observing system buoys and
exactly.
things like gliders. And, you know,
yeah, the gliders
we should
are
be
amazing.
Yeah. And people, you know, you can listen from these sensors. It becomes a data management kind of issue. But, you know,
they're quiet, too. Right. The gliders can go everywhere and they're silent.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, people should be telling Sam Farr and Barbara Boxer and our elected people that, hey, you know, if we're monitoring the oceans as we are, and we should be listening to them in a more deliberate and dedicated way. And these technologies are out there. They're available. They're being used. They're just, they haven't been sort of nationally synthesized in a civilian system that people can use and listen and form kind of management decisions. But also back to the public outreach and public impact. For people to hear, you know, the kind of sounds you have going on here, if people could click on something and hear a fin whale calling off of the coast of Oregon, you know, the ability of that to capture somebody's attention beyond just a picture or, an article or something like that. I mean, the impact of experiencing the acoustic world of the oceans lets people kind of feel a little bit more connected to it. And we can do that. We could do it better if we had more of a national program of monitoring the ocean's acoustics.
And should we be trying to set up more quiet zones?
I think it's an important part of the discussion. You know, areas where we know that are very, you know, biologically important areas. There are some ship routing kinds of discussions that people have had about things like ship strikes, where we're trying to reduce the potential direct impact of whales from ship strikes. And some of the discussions within the International Maritime Organization have come up upon that, declaring kind of particularly sensitive areas and routing activities around them. I think it, you know, you do have to bear in mind that a lot of these places are noisy naturally, but when there are changes in the patterns of vessel traffic, for instance, in the Channel Islands, there was an air quality rule that was implemented that caused vessels to take a different route into Long Beach, which is the busiest port on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah.
And when that air quality rule went into effect, it completely changed the acoustic environment in the areas that were shifted into. And I think people didn't really necessarily think about that. Where the routing of these things happen could be done in an informed way with things like, I mentioned, this NOAA sound mapping working group, where you have these acoustic models to say, if you put vessels along this track, it could change the acoustic environment in this way. And there's simple kind of things that if you're going to change something, we at least need to be thinking about these things of routing and how it affects the acoustic environment, not just the physical environment.
Really, sea traffic control.
Right, and those things happen. I mean, the Coast Guard is very involved in that kind of routing discussion, and their safety issues and all those kinds of things. But to the extent that they're considered for things like reducing ship strikes, the acoustic component of it is an important part of it as well.
Now, it's not every day where I get to look into the eyes of guys who've looked into the eyes of whales as a profession. So I want to ask you, and we do this with our guests, what is it that you love about your work? What is it that you love about whales?
The thing I like the most, that gets me the most excited, is working on things that nobody's ever studied before. I mean, this project and a few others that I've worked on, you know, we're asking questions and getting answers on things that, you know, that people have never really answered. And I have an incredible value for basic science, but even basic science, I think, science is only as powerful as the effect it has on society and the decisions that it makes. And having science that tells us basic things about these animals so that we can make better decisions and change the things that we do and our impact on the environment that's the part that's exciting to me. It's working on things that I think are really affect the decisions that people make. Jeremy?
Wow, that was really good, Brandon.
Yeah.
Along those, so I'm more of a basic researcher. Brandon does a lot more applied science as well as basic research. But thing that's most exciting for me is having freedom to creatively ask questions, and that kind of ability is really exciting. Mm-hmm.
Jeremy's a pretty understated guy. He was involved in a paper and a discovery of a new sensory system and sensory organ in whales that it facilitates their feeding. That was a cover article in Nature recently. Well, so he's done some really groundbreaking work himself.
Well, we really hope to have updates throughout your field season. I know you have an exciting season coming up. You're about to take off on the SoCal project.
Yeah, if people go to SoCal-SOCAL-BRS.org, people will link to the website, and they can find our blog from there. We'll be tracking things in the field and in real time, and people can keep track of us from there. And I guess I'll throw in just at the very end here, I have a book coming out in about a month called Ocean Journeys Beginnings. People can find that from the website too in about a month. That should be out. So I really appreciate you having us. It's been wonderful.
It has been. And we hope for updates. We hope you can call or Skype in on It's the Way of Love. And we love whales, so we really hope you continue your research and get a lot more data that can help the whales and other marine mammals.